Hello, this is Paul Saunders with the Center for the National Interest. Thank you for signing on to listen to Three Questions. I'm excited today to have with me my colleague, Greg Priddy. Greg is a senior fellow at the center where he covers the Middle East region and has a long background prior to his time at the center working on that region and on some related issues like energy at the Eurasia Group and as a contractor at the U.S. Energy Information Administration. So, Greg, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
I thought we would focus our three questions today on President Trump's recent trip to the Middle East. And I guess as a departure point, he went recently to Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and also to Qatar. There were a variety of sort of headline-grabbing economic agreements that the president reached during those visits. But how important do you think the trip was?
As presidential overseas visits go, I'd put this in the middle. I don't think this was, you know, something that we're going to look back on as a watershed, but it moved the ball forward in some interesting ways. You know, we had kind of the standard petrodollar recycling, you know, where they announced all of the $1 trillion, $600 billion. And a lot of that I take with a bit of a grain of salt because they're mixing investment and trade. You know, in the case of the Saudi number, they're running a current account deficit with oil prices where they are right now. So that casts a little bit of doubt on it. But that was kind of just bigger than what you usually see on a presidential visit to the region. They also had, you know, an U.S.-Saudi arms sales agreement that was, you know, well over $100 billion, kind of an eye-popping number, but that's really just aggregating together several years of normal arms trade with the Saudis. So those were not new, if big. The new things were, you know, one was the personal business deals. So Trump had a lot of signing ceremonies for business venture, you know, like an investment in his cryptocurrency venture, golf course, things like that. He had personal business that his company was doing, or his companies, in several of the Gulf countries that also were signed on this trip. You know, that's, I guess, a bit of a change in norms from previous presidential visits. But I thought that the most significant thing on this trip, and what makes it, you know, a little bit, it's not a watershed, but I think it moves the ball forward, is President Trump's speech on U.S. policy in the region. And, you know, where he had kind of driven the final nail in the coffin of the freedom agenda and all the notion that the U.S. has a transformative role over there. And I'm sure that, you know, there was a lot of criticism he got from liberals and neoconservatives about, you know, that undermining the U.S. role. But it also, to people in the region, and there are many different shades of opinion in the region, but to many people in the region, that speech actually seemed to be displaying some humility after many years of American arrogance, you know, where we've been suggesting that we have all the solutions for domestic governance, for everything from economic policy to where there's an American solution that we just need to help you achieve. And we were, you know, in Trump's speech, he's really acknowledging that change, if it comes, is going to come from you, the people of the region. There's not a made in Washington solution. And a lot of people over there, particularly in the Gulf, you know, that subset of the Middle East, saw that as respect, you know, that Trump is not treating them as countries that need to be under some form of American tutelage. So that actually resonated quite well in the Gulf. The realization that it's not about us, you know, most of what goes on in the region is about them. It's not about us. That also fit with, you know, Trump had alluded to a big announcement while he was over there. And a lot of people thought that was going to be a business deal. It turned out, though, it was lifting sanctions on Syria. And that kind of fits with this, you know, the theme from the speech, because there had been people, you know, many people who look at this in Washington had been talking about, you know, Syria needed to fulfill the new, you know, Ashara interim government needed to fulfill a series of benchmarks. And there were some think tank reports written about that. There was talk about that from even some people in government. You know, Rubio, I think, had mentioned it at one point, the series of things they need to do in order to earn sanctions relief, as if sanctions are the default, because as everyone remembers, the sanctions were imposed on the Assad regime, which is no longer there, but they're still in place. And so that notion that he would just give Syria a chance to reform on their own without holding that in reserve, you know, to force them to do a series of things to earn that sanctions relief was a departure, definitely, from where I think the majority of the foreign policy establishment in Washington has been on that. But that's also something that to most people in the region resonated well. And, you know, the fact that we don't see Western tutelage as necessary, and that we're willing to give Syria a chance to reform on their own. And one last remark on Syria, you know, it's part of the question there had been, you know, their relationship with Israel and whether they would pose a threat eventually, which I think is probably overplayed, but they're actually talking. The Syrians are denying it, but Syria and Israel have had a series of meetings about security. And so, you know, we've kind of, that has not removed Syria's incentive to talk to the Israelis about how to live together. And that's a good thing.
Second question here. You know, the president obviously visited Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar. There's some places that he didn't go. He didn't go to Israel. He didn't go to Iran. Not that anyone would have expected that, certainly. But the president has been kind of in the middle of trying to negotiate with Iran on its nuclear weapons program. Could you say a little bit about those two complex relationships and how the trip may have impacted them or been affected by them?
On Iran, obviously nobody really expected him to visit Iran. You know, there had been a little bit of speculation that he might, that there might be some sort of head of state meeting or head of government meeting arranged over there by the Gulf Arabs. I never really thought that was going to come to anything. You know, I think where that's important on Iran is more on Trump's discussions with Gulf Arab leaders, where I think that they made the point to him that he needs to be realistic about American demands. It's very different from the situation in the 2010s, where Saudi and other Gulf Arab leaders, you know, often were pushing the U.S. in a more hawkish direction. After the attack on Abqaiq and Quraysh in 2019, when it showed them that they were vulnerable, that has shifted, and they really want to quiet things down and see stability. They also don't think that a military strike would be the answer to the problem. And so I think that, you know, you probably had Gulf Arab leaders trying to nudge Trump in the direction of taking a realistic stance vis-a-vis Iran and coming to a solution on that. On Israel, you know, he didn't visit Israel. I think that was largely about the optics of being there while the offensive in Gaza plays out, and that would not have looked good for him to be right there during that, you know, given that's generating a lot of very, you know, ugly video footage. And, you know, so I wouldn't read too much into that, though, about the U.S.-Israel relationship, which I think is still quite solid. You know, there's been a lot of speculation recently about a chill between Netanyahu and Trump. I think that's true to some extent. It's not fundamentally undermining the relationship, but I do think that they differ on Iran. Clearly, Trump would like to have a deal, very much wants a deal. I'm not sure that there will be one, but he wants one. That's clear. And, you know, they also differ on Gaza, where Trump has been, you know, after talking about making Gaza into the French Riviera and all of that, which was kind of nonsensical, he actually has kind of backed off. He also seemed to endorse population transfer, but he has backed off from that. And I think that talking to Arab leaders probably also influenced him on that, when they've let him know their needs and their, you know, how their population sees it. But, you know, Trump has increasingly been saying very gently, but saying this needs to come to a close. And so that reflects a little bit of tension, but I don't see Trump making any threats or saying he's going to do anything to force Netanyahu's hand on that.
Third and final question for you here today, and you touched on this a little bit already in talking about President Trump's speech, and I certainly agree that it was a pretty significant speech. What do you think this trip by the president says, if anything, about the future of the American role in the Middle East and how it might evolve in the future?
Well, you know, the speech definitely says that he recognizes there are not made in America solutions for everything there. And, you know, as they see it, is displaying a little bit more humility than American leaders have in the recent past. You know, this trip isn't a watershed. It doesn't really change the trajectory, but it moves us a little bit further down that spectrum. I think it also says, though, that, you know, one thing we did not see him pushing was the idea of Saudi-Israel rapprochement and, you know, some sort of security mechanism coming out of that. So it was very different than the Biden administration in that they don't see Saudi-Israel normalization to some sort of bulwark against Iran de jure security guarantee there. So I think Trump is happy to maintain the more informal security relationships that we've had in the Gulf, but he doesn't seem to be interested like Biden was in, you know, in trying to do full treaty commitments. I personally very much agree with that. I think we need to maintain our flexibility to decide when to intervene and when not to. Trump not intervening in 2019 with the Abqaiq strike was the right decision. But if we'd had something informal in place, that might have turned out differently. So I think we need to maintain the judgment. You know, the decision about our intervention is in Washington, you know, even if we're not making decisions about, you know, internal things in the region. I also think that, you know, the U.S. role, Gulf leaders probably told him that their normalization with Iran is coming along pretty well. And so the U.S. had initially been skeptical about that, and I think might become more supportive of that normalization, you know, despite the China angle on it. But this isn't really a watershed where we're moving in a different direction in the region. It just moves the ball forward a bit.
Okay, Greg, thank you again for joining me today on Three Questions. And for those of you listening, again, this is Paul Saunders with the Center for the National Interest interviewing my colleague, Greg Priddy, our senior fellow covering the Middle East. Hope you'll all sign on again in 2 weeks. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks.